Let's begin. Let's begin. I don't feel bad if we are taking, you know, a great deal of time on this introduction. That's the way we need to, really. And the other chapters do go faster. But we ended up with Lewis saying that there's something called a likeness or godlike quality, likenesses to God, and then nearness of approach to God, and that those are that distinction is very significant. It was to him. He says this when I first ran into it. It also wrecked all my previous attempts to write about love. And when we face it, something like this seems to result. And it is that important. And how have you responded to that up to this, you know, time? The difference between likeness and godlike qualities? And what are they? And what's their place? Is there a place for them? And what is the nearness of approach that he's talking about?
Wouldn't it be something like what in that version of man, if then you're mislikeness, if you're on one hand, if it's well, wasn't it likeness comes up, it's good to be nearness of approach. Mm-hmm. Or if you're too much likeness, being like within the Tao or something like that, and that in a sense kind of destroys it. It would, I don't think it would, it meant that we weren't capable of that.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring up the Tao, because that's very important in the abolition of man. And the qualities, godlike qualities, would be those things that are mentioned in the Tao, those branches of the Tao that we talked about, like justice, freedom, and so forth, and integrity, duty, responsibility, so forth, honesty. And those are all branches of the Tao, and those are all godlike qualities to exhibit that, you know, that kind of thing.
It just seems that if you're so much, whereas likeness is compared to nearness of approach, if you lack it, you'd destroy it, because then it wouldn't be above us anymore, it wouldn't be something that had authority over us. So if you were too much like, wasn't it apostle Paul was supposed to be the most perfect person ever, was the most godlike, but yet he even tried to keep that up for a while. I think it was that.
But you have the godlike.
I mean, I should think it would destroy it.
If you
that, well, that nearness of approach is kind of similar to what he was saying. How he's in that book we read, Cloister in the Hearth, when the Erasmus's father was dying, how he saw visions of God and was almost like conversing with him. How that sort of thing happens, he makes that distinction there.
And that would be.
That would be the nearness of approach.
Nearness of approach.
Yeah. Whereas likeness is almost to have the same qualities as.
And what does Lewis say the big difference is between the godlike qualities, having godlike qualities, and the nearness of approach? One is a matter of what?
Given.
The one is given, and which is that?
Likeness.
Certain of the godlike qualities are given. And they're built into us, he says. The potential's for them. And some people are just plain more patient than others. You know, really, just... And more gentle and more... they're just so different. They're built in at different degrees. And we don't have that much to do about that. Those qualities. And then the nearness of approach is a matter of what?
Well, he gave that example.
He just says it. What is a matter of what?
Is that like when you're on
your own personal growth?
When he says they're really different, and one you are given, and if something is given you don't choose it, and then the other would probably be you choose it, and you have to do something about it. You have to make a certain kind of choice. There is some kind of movement that you make toward God. And as Carol's saying, you know, he isn't a cosmic peeping Tom. He doesn't beat the door down, you know. That there is some kind of movement that you make. Now, this phrase for me, a nearness of approach, and I think about myself, and I can't remember myself so much moving toward him as he moving toward me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Lewis seems to be using this in that the person moves nearness of approach.
And he
says, the person goes down into the, you know, goes around and takes the long detour and is actually farther away from where he wants to go, God, at times, and then finally gets down there. And to me, that image has always been one where Christ comes down to me.
Except here he says, though, the states in which man is nearest to God are those in which he is most surely and swiftly approaching his final union with God, vision of God, enjoyment of God. So, I mean, that's probably...
But if you go by the way it sounds that you're saying it, Scott, then we are never nearness of approach until we're almost at the end of our life.
I'm not saying he said that.
I don't think he's saying that. I think he's saying, like on page 16 at the bottom, he says, the approach, however initiated and supported by grace, is something we must do. And I wrote on the side, it's acceptance of Jesus Christ as our Savior. And I think that's, to me, that's what he's saying. I may be wrong.
Well, the acceptance is a movement toward, but I think, you know, when he's talking that you are trying to, in the next page, he's talking about imitation.
He also says that it's a task, but it's a task that we're not doing on our own.
Yeah, we're always supported. That's something that I'll, you know, in certain places with Lewis, I'll say, you're saying that we can do all these things. You know, and then he always will say, no, you can't do it by yourself. Where I would emphasize more the beggarliness, I guess, and maybe that's my Lutheran as opposed to, what, Anglican? I don't know. But I think nearness of approach, I say, he came down and pitched his tent among us, down to me. And I remember writing a poem once about the, you know, that where, you know, if you ever feel like you're missing God, go back where you left him. You left him in your sin because it was so uncomfortable. And go back there, and there's where he is. He is, you know, takes on the sin of the world. And that's where he is, waiting for you in that. And that's primary, you know, his, to me, is the context of meaning for Christ. The primary context of meaning is that he has, you know, he has forgiven me. And that doesn't make any sense if I get away from any conception of myself as a person who does sin or die continually. And if I go to that, that's where he is. And so he comes down to me. In a sense, I have to approach where? Heaven? Or do I have to approach what? What, you know, what's that town like? Now, these are things that we can't settle in this point, and he doesn't give us enough information to say, get really specific about it. But I keep approaching him, and I go to the cross where the guy's, you know, which where he is taken on the sin of the world, and as I approach him, I approach my sin and his forgiveness, and so that's keeps the way I see it, and it's hard for me to reconcile that understanding of it with the tone of what he is saying here. I would think he'd say more if that's quite what he meant. I don't really know. Al, do you have anything to help out on that? Good point. It's been a long time since you read it, and I don't have that book to you yet.
John, would nearness of approach be more becoming human then, or becoming person, rather than I'm getting all these qualities now that are going to not make me more godlike, but indeed more human?
The qualities would make, I think, would make us more human in many ways. But I guess how well do we do that? That's one thing. How well do we go after godlike qualities? How good have we been at it in the past? You know, how self-consciously can one go try to achieve the godlike qualities? You know, it reminds me of the story that Pastor Thompson in Minneapolis told in a sermon. He says that the couple was having a real difficulty. The husband and wife had a lot of difficulty, and they came to him for counseling. And she says, "Pastor, you've got to pray that I be patient." You know, and he says, "No, I won't pray for your that you be patient." "What do you mean?" You know, and she says, which means that she maybe needs a little of it. But he says, "You don't need patience. You need Christ, and you need to pray. You know, you need Christ with you and His whole gospel, and not one part of it. It may be it isn't just patience that you need, and you can't get it. And you're gonna feel like remember the Tao in Abolition of Man, where we see all these good things, and we take one of them. All of those godlike qualities are like branches of a tree, and our hands are so small, we break off one of those branches." And we carry that around and say, "This is the tree. This is the way. No, the whole thing is the way. But this is the way." And of course, no fruit is born. Another image, you take the difference between the primary difference between animals, as say apes and men, as far as hands go, is that we have the opposing thumb. And you say, "Oh, so the most important man-like quality is the thumb. So you cut all the other fingers off and you got a thumb." You know, and the point is the opposing. But you've lost that, and you get this huge old bloated the one thing, and you can't do anything with it. It's in my nature, at least. I can't do more than one thing at a time. If I try to be gentle, well, then I'm going to miss certain. I mean, I will be not the person that other people need, because I can only think gentle at one time consciously. I'm going to try to be gentle. Ick. I'm sure I'm going to come out like saccharine. You know. And sometimes you can't be gentle, as you know. Sometimes a response sometimes the response that your situation demands is not one that looks gentle. Because we have all these little images that go along with gentleness that in our lives are not, and we're not always called to be gentle, maybe. Sometimes we need a good kick in the butt. Jump in here too, because I'm not, as I was talking to Karen today, it's a very hard book to present. You can't present this book, you've got to read it. and in reading it, we have to talk about some of the different, the difficult portions. I certainly cannot state what Lewis says better than he does. And it's a kind of book sometimes, well, let's look at what he says, what he says about it. But to read it, we have to discuss it, so feel free.
I'm confused now what nearness of approach is, you said that it's a returning to the cross and accepting that.
To me, This is where I say nearness of approach, and then right away I think that he came right down to me. Mm. And it's not that I climb up any kind of ladder to get to him, but he came down to me. And maybe that's just the stage of my own time as a Christian, because right now that's the most important thing, that he came down to me. We've got God that stumbles to a throne, and he doesn't ask us to, gracefully, climb up a ladder of perfection.
Could he be saying here, like then, nearness of likeness we all have, everybody has likeness qualities.
Mm-hmm.
The nearness of approach is the chosen.
Mm-hmm. I think you would say that's the most important.
Yeah, he says right there, he says the nearness of approach is by definition increasing nearness. And whereas the likeness is given to us and can be received with or without thanks, can be used or abused, the approach, however initiated, is supported by grace, is something we must do.
Yeah. We must do. And I don't know if he means going, I don't know exactly what he means, we must do, but what is the do? Do?
Well, it's
approach. What are we approaching?
It's up to us.
Yeah, but what are we approaching?
I took it as your reaction to God, and if you push it to any very far at all, you'll end up with work righteousness, which obviously he didn't mean. Mm-hmm. But he's just talking here about, I think, your reactions and your activities that are carried on.
Well, you're getting works righteousness in there, so, you know. But I missed what you said then. This is just.
If you push it, if you say more than what he said, yes, you end up with that. But I think what he's talking about is your reaction to God and your activities.
It's in your doing, and not in your being.
Right.
Well, let's read. Because some don't have books here. And I'll read just this passage again. And whereas the likeness is given to us, and can be received with or without thanks, can be used or abused, the approach, however initiated and supported by grace, is something we must do. Creatures are made in their varying ways images of God without their own collaboration or even consent. It is not so that they become sons of God. It is not so that they become sons of God by being given these certain qualities of God, like everyone's got this built-in likeness. And the likeness they receive by sonship is not that of images or portraits. It is one way. It is in one way more than likeness, for it is union or unity with God in will. You become a son by nearness of approach. Is that it? And then you talk about likenesses again. Unity. Union or unity with God and will, but this is consistent with all the differences we have been considering. Hence, it is as a better writer said, our imitation of God in this life, that is our willed imitation, as distinct from any of the likenesses which He has impressed upon our natures or states, must be an imitation of God incarnate in flesh. Our model is the Jesus, not only of Calvary, but of the workshop, the roads, the crowds, and the clamorous demands and the surly oppositions, the lack of all peace and privacy and interruptions. For this, so strangely unlike anything we can attribute to the divine life in itself, is apparently not only like, but is the divine life operating under human conditions. Like? The divine life operating under human conditions. And as Keith was saying, there, it's some of our, it's our doing. I mean, we get in, sometimes when you talk about godlike qualities, you're going to end up in the cloister. If that's the most important thing, you just stay out of trouble. You know, and you go hide, and then you can feel that you have virtue, godlike qualities. I really don't understand this passage. I'm not comfortable with
it. It makes very good sense with the rest of the chapter when he says what happens if you press and push anything to the extreme.
Yeah?
Something I got out of it, I don't know if it's anything, but this is so strangely unlike anything we can attribute to the divine life. He's talking about the imitation of Christ as being so different from what we would normally assume to be what the divine is.
Yeah.
Because for us, we try to, you know, any kind of powers that we might have, power over other people or being powerful, just on earth, that's one of the first things that comes to mind when I think of divine, sort of omnipotent over all things, and that Christ was so different from that kind of a view. You know, he was all the things that it seems ridiculous to be if we're looking at this life as being, you know, a finite life. I mean, he just didn't fit in with things coming to an end. He didn't seem to have the right goals and wasn't going for the right things, you know. But if you look at it at an infinite sense, which we don't, you know, then those things make sense, and then they're divine. But when we try to make divine into something finite, then we screw it all up.
We have, that does make a lot of sense, that how many godlike qualities did Jesus exhibit at any given time? Was that the point? I mean, did he go around trying to be gentle, kind, good, and so forth?
Yeah.
Are you trying to control his temper? And so forth. And he had one. Being a man, he had one, and he showed it too. And it goes in the temple, throws over the tables, and starts cussing. You vipers, brood, you sons of bloop, 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 whatever, and oof stuff. And he just checks where we go. You know, we assume godlike qualities, that's what we're here for. We'll get them. We'll be patient and kind and so forth. And that's not, he's just saying, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. If we're going to be like, we're not going to be like, try to get the likenesses to God, the qualities, the godlike qualities, but a likeness to the God on human terms, the divine life in human terms. That's Christ. And what is Christ like? What does he do? What's his life like? It was lived in the workshops, the roads, the crowds, the clamorous demands, the surly oppositions, the lack of all peace, which doesn't strike us as very godlike, privacy and interruptions. For this, so strangely unlike anything we can attribute to the divine life in itself, is apparently not only like, but is the divine life operating under human conditions?
Yep.
Yeah.
It was also living totally under the will of the Father. You know, it wasn't, he wasn't, demanding things of his own, you know, or demanding his personal rights or his, you know, anything. He wasn't demanding his divine rights.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think that too, that living under the will of the Father.
It makes me think, like we were talking about the other day, about knowing what God's will is. You know, being in a certain situation and looking for it and then remaining true, if you want to use that thing, to God's will in everything. That's a maintain our nearness of approach, that whole idea of, you know, looking for the divine will as much as is possible in human terms, as he says. You know, when you were talking about finding God's will, you know, what is God's will for me?
Mm-hmm.
It's more or less the attitude or your approach or this your reaction to your situation that you're in. You know, keeping your eye on God.
Mm-hmm. I think God, in that sense, God wills response from us
mm-hmm.
in whatever situation. I cannot say that God wills, child to die.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot say that he wills that at all. I can say that his will, I can understand his will in relationship to me in the way I respond to it. And it's in that response right now when I think of the will of God. I think, you know, what does he will for me? He wills a kind of a response and a kind of action from me that has attempts an imitation of Christ.
I think Karin and Manns this morning said that from Barth, that Carol quote, God's will is Jesus, you know, what's the divine will? Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the quote, you know, that's not, we ask God's will is Jesus and how that comes to us.
Mm-hmm. I missed the
Manns. Yeah, it's really super. It was on when they went on the retreat.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Part of what Lewis is doing here, and as Keith says, it's very, you know, it is simple what he means in relation to what follows in this whole passage. And yet you can get caught up in it. I can get caught up in it. You can get caught up in it more. We can't understand it in relation to what Shepard says later. He says, I must now explain why I have found this distinction necessary to any treatment of our loves. St. John saying that God is love has long been balanced in my mind against the remark of a modern scholar, Rougemont, that love ceases to be a demon only when he ceases to be a god. Of course, which can of course be restated in the form love begins to be a demon the moment he begins to be a god. This balance seems to me an indispensable safeguard. If we ignore it, the truth that God is love may slyly come to mean for us the converse, that love is God. And I think many, you know, one of the devil's primary ways of working is to slyly come to mean the converse. You know, we say lots of things. God is love, love is God. No, that's not true. God is honest. Well, honesty is being, you know, is the high thing. God, I mean, we can't approach God except through a kind of a complete honesty, and then we try and we end up like a bunch of cripples, a bunch of intellectual and emotional cripples trying to be honest. To which one of our various selves, you know, are we going to be honest? But we keep turning these around. God is nature, nature is God. Yeah, we keep messing it up. I suppose that everyone who has thought about the matter will see what is meant. Every human love, at its height, has a tendency to claim for itself a divine authority. Now, love is one of those godlike qualities that we talk about. That's why he has to say that, you know, that isn't the top, that isn't the highest goal, is to have those qualities. I mean, those are beautiful things to have, those godlike qualities. Freedom, like you remember the Tao? Freedom, wow! And then we start saying that freedom is the most important thing, and it isn't. Freedom is very important. Responsibility is very important. There are lots of things. If we're being free and arrogant, or free and rebellious, are we good? You know, we it's not so easy. We can't just take one of those godlike qualities and say this is it, and without it becoming a demon, whether it's love or freedom or responsibility. I've got enough German blood in me to know what responsibility becomes if you make it a god. And I see you walking along like, you know, like I've got 2,000 pounds in my back, you know, and not enjoying anything. You know, that's responsibility. You know, and we keep taking one of these godlike qualities or one of the branches of the Tao, breaking it off, and it bloats itself to madness and isolation from all the rest. That's the phrase from Abolition of Man. And here, love at its height has a tendency to claim for itself divine authority. Divine authority, and it doesn't have, its voice tends to sound as if it were the will of God himself. It tells us not to count the cost. It demands of us a total commitment. It attempts to override all other claims and insinuates that any action which is sincerely done for love's sake is thereby lawful and even meritorious. That erotic love and love of one's country may thus attempt to become gods is generally recognized, but family affection may do the same. So in a different way may friendship. I shall not here elaborate the point, for it will meet us again in later chapters. And he does write a chapter on each of these kinds of love. Somebody wants to say something.
I can't help but see, after doing this tutorial on George MacDonald, one of the stories that George MacDonald wrote about was, the first chapter was this witch named Watho, and she wanted to know what love was, all these different things, and one of the last things she wanted to know was a wolf, and not for the sake of, you know, getting everything out of it, but just for knowing it, you know, to make it into a god, and then it turned out into a demon for her. And there's one little sentence, you know, the wolf would get out of her mind and onto her back,
yeah,
all the time, you know. I mean,
that's a nice,
it just seems like a lot of Lewis's.
What does he say a few pages before? My master?
Mm-hmm.
McDonald,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. McDonald's my master. He meant that much to him. This thing that he gets, you know, getting on your back and riding you. And it's all these godlike things are beautiful riders, you know. We want them associated with us. He says here, about the middle of that 18, This is especially obvious in the erotic sphere. A faithful and genuinely self-sacrificing passion will speak to us with what seems the voice of God. A faithful and genuinely self-sacrificing passion will speak to us with what seems to be the voice of God. Merely animal or frivolous lust will not. It will corrupt its addict in a dozen ways, but not in that way. A man may act upon such feelings, but he cannot revere them any more than a man who scratches reveres the itch. It's a silly woman's temporary indulgence, which is really self-indulgence, to a spoiled child, her living doll while the fit lasts. I love that. Her living doll while the fit lasts. Is much less likely to become a god than the deep, narrow devotion of a woman who quite really lives for her son. Self-sacrificing and everything, and it becomes her kind of idol or god. And I'm inclined to think that the sort of love for a man's country, which is worked up by beer and brass bands, will not lead him to do much harm or much good for her sake. It will probably be fully discharged by ordering another drink and joining in the chorus. And then he says, this is of course what we ought to expect. And he always says, those cracks of his always embarrass me. You know. Oh, yeah. This is of course. And, you know, what do you mean, of course? You know, this book is a continual joyful embarrassment. As he cuts the fat and the confusion and the garbage that of our beliefs about this most important term, and he'll do it again and again and again. And you say, and this of course is what we ought to expect. And, Our loves do not make their claim to divinity until the claims become plausible. And of course, that the idols that we make, I mean, of these godlike qualities, they're beautiful. There's a lot of godlikeness in them, but they're not God. Single quality. Does not become plausible until there is some real resemblance to God, to love himself. And when you... And you question someone's love, the assumption is, well, you think it's just lust. No, it's love, maybe. Okay, granted, it might be the highest self-sacrificing love around, but, it doesn't override other callings and demands, on us. It isn't God. So you don't obey that love if it takes you where the Word of God tells you not to go. Our gift loves are really godlike. Our gift loves are really godlike, and among our gift loves, those are most godlike which are most boundless and unwearied in giving. All the things the poets say about them are true. Their joy, their energy, their patience, their readiness to forgive, their desire for the good of the beloved. All this is a real and all but adorable image of the divine life. It is in its presence, we are right to thank God who has given such power to men. And that's my response to this book. We may say quite truly and in an intelligible sense that those who love greatly are near to God. But of course, it is nearness by likeness. It will not of itself produce nearness of approach. The likeness has been given us. The capacity for those likenesses has been given us. It has no necessary connection with that slow and painful approach which must be our own, though by no means unaided, task. Meanwhile, however, the likeness is a splendor. That is why we may mistake like for same. What is like God is not the same as God. Just that quick, simple, another of the embarrassments is that what he's saying is so simple. He states it so simply. Like is not same. It's one of the basic principles of reason, right? And but we forget. We may give our human loves the unconditional allegiance which we owe only to God. Then they become gods. Then they become demons. Then they will destroy us and also destroy themselves. And that's why he writes the book so that the affections kill us not nor die. And then this is a restatement of what that means. We give our human loves the unconditional allegiance which we owe only to God. Then they become gods. Then they become demons. Then they will destroy us and also destroy themselves. For natural loves that are allowed to become gods do not remain loves. They are still called so, but can become, in fact, complicated forms of hatred. Mufta. And this is where Judy's comment the other day was so important. It comes up now. He's not debunking. He's not saying that love is, come on now, let's see, love is way down here. This kind of love is way down here. And what we need is up here. No, he says these are great. These are great. But they're not God. And like isn't same. And he's very concerned not to make you quit loving strawberries. By saying, oh, that's just junk down there. It follows from what has been said that we must join neither the idolaters nor the debunkers of human love. Neither the idolaters nor the debunkers of human love. Idolatry both of erotic love and of the domestic affections was the great error of the 19th century literature. Browning, Kinsley, and Patmore sometimes talk as if they thought that falling in love was the same thing as sanctification. Well, then we can go ho ho those guys, but ho ho myself. And you probably had that in your past. And you may have it in your present. And probably while the fit lasts, you'll have it in your future. But to remember that love is not the same as sanctification. The novelists habitually oppose the world to the world, not the kingdom of heaven, but the home. We live in a reaction against this. We're the age of the debunkers. Stigmatizes slush and sentimentality a very great deal of what their fathers said in praise of love. They are always pulling up and exposing the grubby roots of, I love this passage, the grubby roots of our natural loves. And we talked a little about this yesterday, about how we trace down our loves to all these needs and everything, and it's just purely, absolutely selfish need, and so it's crappy and everything. And they love this passage. They are always pulling up and exposing the grubby roots of our natural loves. But I take it we must listen neither to the overwise nor to the overfoolish giant. The highest does not stand without the lowest. A plant must have roots below as well as sunlight above, and roots must be grubby. Much of the grubbiness is clean dirt, if only you will leave it in the garden and not keep sprinkling it over the library table. It's beautiful. The human loves can be glorious images of divine love, no less than that, but also no more. He wants those loves to be known and appreciated so that we can see them as glorious images of divine love, so that we have a means of understanding divine love, and not, he doesn't want anything less than that, but also no more. Proximities of likeness, which in one instance may help and in another may hinder proximity of approach. Sometimes, perhaps, they have not very much to do with it either way. Proximities of likeness, which in one instance may help and in another hinder proximity of approach. Sometimes the likenesses may not have much to do with it in either way, the approach. Well, what about that? That's the end of that introduction. What about that?
This may not be on target, but do we seek God because of the godlike qualities that we projected into God? Or do we seek God because He is God? I think of...
Could you say that again?
Do we seek God or move toward Him? I realize that you've got the other motif, that God moves toward you. But do we seek God because He is God and not because He is patient and kind and forgiving and loving and all of these qualities that He's got, which in a subtle way may finally mean that I want the forgiveness of my sins. Mm-hmm. I don't want Him necessarily, but I'd like to have Him deposit that in the bank so I can draw on it and have peace of mind. I'd just as soon not have Him, you know, in my living room if He deposit this in the bank for me, that would be nice. Mm-hmm. Now, when Job cried out in the moment when there was no evidence of God caring for him at all, in a sense a vindictive God or an indifferent God or whatever, that's when he cried, if he killed me, I will trust him. Mm-hmm. You know? Not asking for his credentials. I'm just wanting him, no matter what. Now, you know, these motifs are there crisscrossing, so that this is kind of a purist position. But I memorized one of the poems, or one of the prayers, of George MacDonald in the Diary of an Old Soul. And it's a beautiful thing. He says, not, Lord, because I have done well or ill, not because my mind looks up to thee clear-eyed, not that it struggles in fast cerements tied, not because I need thee daily, sore still, not that I wretched wander from thy will, not now for any cause to thee I cry, but this, that thou art thou, and here am I. You know? Mm-hmm. Here you are, and here I am. Mm-hmm. And that's all. Not because I need forgiveness, not because I'm wretched, not for anything at all. I'm not asking for dividends, I'm just asking for you. Mm-hmm. I'm here. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're a sadist, I'm in trouble, but I want you.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's one note, I think, that do we ever really thank God for himself, but are we always thanking him for the stuff he delivers? Mm-hmm. And well, that's really kind of an aside, I think. But you're talking.
It's not so much as an aside as a cap. You know, it goes over the top of the whole thing. To me, it's the.
And of course you can't dissociate.
Yeah,
you can't get to God in a pure, undefined image. You've got all these qualities, these godlike qualities, that he's revealed. So that to want him and to want to be with him is, I suppose, to want these qualities too.
The qualities disassociate themselves from I don't want those as a bank. I mean, it's for me. It's so much as for you. You know, in the sense that God is there. And in that sin, I don't say, you know, forgive my wretched sin. I say, Abba, Father. And I think that is a little bit what MacDonald is, you know, that I do have a Heavenly Father. That you are that. I can't disassociate him from the Father. And then all of a sudden, you're into more than just being. You're my Father. And I'm glad that I do have a Heavenly Father. And you're going to kick me around sometime, you know, all sorts of things can happen to me, but you are my Father, and I'm glad to know that. And the image for me is when I was in the mental hospital, and I'm down in that room, and it's a solitary cell, and I'm not alone. And to know that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's mm-hmm. what you're, mm-hmm. a little bit of what MacDonald was talking about.
Yeah.
And it's not so much that you're doing, it's just that I'm not alone. And it's not these things that you're doing to me, but just that you're around. You're here, you're under and over and around me and all that. And And then these things that he does for us. I keep thinking of that lately in terms of everyone else. I mean, it's important, you know, it's important for you that I'm Jeff. You know, and he's taking care of me. But it's important for the other people. It's important for the brothers that you have some of those. But you can't self-consciously pick which one you've got to have. And that, you know, he picks this, you know, the action for the season and so forth. But it's very easy to think of God in terms of what he does for us, and what he allows us to do, like speak in tongues or something, and what he does for us, and what he allows us to have. I love you because you have given me joy. You know, I can have joy, live joy. Well, I think down at that statement, Abba, Father, has got to be there too. Mm-hmm. And you believe, you know, Ike Lewis has a little essay that he says, well, you know, I mean, you believe in God because it's true. You don't believe it because it works or because it brings you any of these things, because it's true. You know, God's really, I mean, that's real. I think he's getting at a little bit of McDonald's, this poem.
I suppose the book of Job is a great book. In a greater sense, that all these chapters, Job is shaking his fist at God for an unfair deal. Mm-hmm. This is, and yet he doesn't let him go. And he doesn't abandon him, he claims him, mm-hmm. injustice notwithstanding. And that's, and I suppose faith is at its best when it just doesn't lean on anything.
That's right, and that. The business of Job is just, you know, astounding. You know, I mean, just to read that, and that he's, you know, even as he's almost cursing, he's trusting, and if he wasn't doing some complaint, he wouldn't be who he should be and what he should be. I mean, if he just lay down. Or jumped out of the sort of that place God would have us live. He stayed there. This is where he wants me in this relationship, and I'll stay here, and I'm not going to say, you got to hell with you and leave. I'm going to stay here, and it's not nice, and and so forth. And sometimes I think cursing as you have written in a note, is sometimes part of a prayer can be, may I curse in due season. And I think that's part of it, not so that we cut out that our creatureness, that we were created as creatures, and some of that, if we aren't doing that, sometimes we've ceased to be what he made.
Yeah, George MacDonald has a statement somewhere that God does not want or enjoy a weary collapse.
could you say that again?
God does not want or enjoy a weary collapse, is where you capitulate. He's given you freedom. Mm-hmm. He kind of enjoys having to stand up to him.
Yeah. This girl says drag kicking to the altar, you know, every step of the way, you know. And I think that we can do operations on ourselves so that we cease to be what he wants us to be as a creature. I hate the word adjusted. I just hate it, you know. Adjusted, ooh.
Surrender, too. The word surrender gets you too, I think, kind of a I know it's a good word, but instead of surrendering to his will, you embrace his will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the other thing.
I would think, though, that for most people, seek God because he's God, and they don't really care what kind of God it's going to be. And I think that's when he's talking about love becoming God. I think that's what results in when a person only is seeking God and not interested in, doesn't give thought to what kind of God, and they want, they don't like the ambiguity that may go along in trying to understand what God is. And rather than deal with the ambiguity, they just make love as their God. I think that you can see it in almost anything. I've never thought of it as becoming God. I always thought of, you know, worshiping the law. People will always buy the law more than the gospel because it's easier to understand. It gives the answers. And for the majority, that is what they seem to want, is the answers. And,
it's pleased with not buying the ambiguity. I don't.
The ambiguity is, would you use mystery as a synonym?
No, I think they want clear-cut answers. And I think that society, you can see it in the churches that tend to grow at this period of time now, are churches that can lay it out flat on the line as these are the answers. And if you can't give them the straight answers, what you're saying, that there is freedom, that you have freedom, that you can stand up to God, that is not, to say, as successful religion at the time, John. Religion now is sold not as an end in itself, but as a means to an end.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And love was that in the 60s. The flower children, and most I see it in the students I get. It's they just don't buy that now, and it's just a reversal.
What is it now? Love in the 60s. What is it now?
Now, how do I get a job?
Yeah.
Books that you thought were very important, did they actually believe that? I mean, criticism of bureaucracy, taught a course in organizations, bureaucracy. Big thing, even 3 years ago, was is bureaucracy necessary? Maybe you can do away with it. The response is, people really didn't believe that, did they?
Mm.
I mean, how can society exist? You have to have it. What is the law? I want the answers. So we've gone from a period from a seeking to a period where they want answers. They want a 50-minute lecture.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask something that might be changing a little bit, but talking about the like God chooses the season and the flavor of the season, and so he places in us characteristics. He places in us all those gifts, those divine gifts. And for some of us gentleness, for some of us, you know, strong convictions, all those different things. But I wonder about some of those things being cultivated. And I'm thinking very strongly of something I read from John Bailey recently about, in 1 Peter it says, "Be ye holy just as I am holy." And how would that fit in with the approach business?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that we're without sin. It's not that we don't recognize that, but it's a striving towards.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that just pops in my mind, be ye holy as I'm holy, is that Jesus wasn't holy in the way man thinks of holiness. But when I think of what's holy, I don't think of futzing around in the cornfields and getting oxygen and so forth. I think about all these that God, like he speaks to this in this first this introduction a little bit. But my conception of holiness was I am perfect and divine and I kind of glow and everything and so forth. But it's a different kind of holiness. This is not true. I'm going to say it's not true, but it's meaningful, in the sense that Christ was crucified for not being a holy man.
Well, Peely puts it in the form of being our sinful selves, but we're striving.
It's funny. Striving, yes.
We're
praying
to God or Christ at the end.
Yeah. I don't say I'll give up. You'd increase. You'd increase in all these qualities, but you'd grow like an apple and not like in one direction. My tendency is to grow. If I consciously pick one, I'll have to pick one of the things. I'll think what I am. Am I gentle? Am I forceful? And then I'll be over forceful and over too gentle. And so forth, and I will get a linear, development kind of thing going. But I think, through prayer, we can grow in all directions at the same time, like an apple, and just grow. And we certainly can't grow if we're measuring it. Philippians means an awful lot to me when it says, you look at the good, the noble, and the true, and to look at these things, to know what the loves are. To try to know them, and look to them, and all of them, not just one of them, and maybe other people will find that you mellowed or gotten more forceful and so forth. I can't handle any self-conscious attempt to grow in the godlike qualities. I cannot. I personally can't. I've tried that, and it's not just because I've tried at it and failed. I just don't think that's what he had in mind.
But that we have our own interpretation.
Well, that we self-consciously attempt this perfection business. Now we are called to be perfect, and we need. And once we are, we say you're. In a given day, maybe a person needs all those qualities manifest in your life, incarnated in your deeds and words and so forth. But the need is so great. I mean, the help that I need to live, to be for people what they need is so great that I've just got to, just pray like crazy. There's not much I can do about doing that. I think that's where you get the unity of will, and it isn't that your will is the same as God's will, but you pray that your will in union with God's will, and really you strive, but not linearly, in a line toward that one thing. You go out all. I'm not making sense. This isn't making sense to me. But I think that striving for one of the godlike qualities is like chasing a ping pong ball across a swimming pool. It gets farther and farther and farther and farther away from you the harder you go after it.
How does that relate then to the likeness by the coach?
Well, I don't think it's you're not approaching that with perfection. You're approaching God. And where is he? Not at the top of the ladder. but at the bottom of the cross. I guess that's just me.
Mm-hmm. Also, I think of the fruits of the Spirit, like gentleness and kindness and all those, and that is what we get as a result of seeking God. I mean, that's not the goal in itself to want those things, but because of our of seeking God's will or of accepting God, but the center, the focus is Christ. You know, and then as a result of that focus, or of that as the center, then we will receive the other things as God sees fit, but not to seek Him. And that helps me to get Him in perspective, because those will come as we seek towards God, but the cross has to be at the center. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not the goal, is to seek Him. I don't know if that helps at all, but that helps me. That has come, especially from this year, to help me understand that a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
For people who seek, who want to be good and kind and gentle, that's not the point. It's, I mean, those will come as a result of our trusting in God. Mm-hmm. But that's not the goal itself. Mm-hmm. I mean, you need all of them at different times, too.
So sometimes I do, sometimes I haven't. Sometimes I may have needed, you know, some other things.
Mm-hmm.
I really needed to get a 2x4 across my psyche, you know. You know, I needed that. Thanks, I needed that. Mm-hmm. You know, I really needed it. You know.
Sometimes you really need anger, and that isn't a God-like quality, as mm-hmm. you think of.
Why not?
I think it's
yeah. It's just not one of those you
think right. of.
When you think of like the same thing you're talking about, being holy, is Jesus holy? You don't think of that as being
mm-hmm. good. It's not one of our common holy things. Ideas. Is there any more on that difference? Between likeness and approach, God to God, of God, and those likenesses. Read it, just a statement of why does he write the book? And again, because of the nature of the book, this can seem like an odd description. We've been talking about it. Very defining, and that's what he does. It's definitions. And I'm just thinking anyway, this seems to make sense a bit. All natural affections, including this, and this one of the natural affections, can become rivals to spiritual love. But they can also be preparatory imitations of it, training, so to speak, of the spiritual muscles which grace may later put into a higher service, as women nurse dolls in childhood and later nurse children. There may become an occasion for renouncing this love, pluck out your right eye, but you need to have an eye first. You need to have an eye first before you can pluck it out. But you need to have an eye first. A creature which had none, which had only got so far as a photosensitive spot, would be very ill employed in meditation on that severe text.
Just say that again, John. Page
42. 42. I'm sorry, I thought I said that.
No.
42. Bottom of 41, then the three words, and then on 42. All natural affections, including this, can become rivals to spiritual love, but they can also be preparatory imitations of it, training, so to speak, of the spiritual muscles which grace may later put into a higher service. Women nurse dolls in childhood and later nurse children. There may come an occasion for renouncing this love, pluck out your right eye, But you need to have an eye first. A creature which had none, which had only got so far as a photosensitive spot, would be very ill employed in meditation on that severe text.
Makes me think of this. In itself isn't bad, you know, a love in itself isn't bad until, of course, it becomes a demon. But you have to have that love first in order to begin to experience a higher level. I mean, is it good to be so that you're or become aware of the other types of love? I guess not to put it on a different level, because they, according to Lewis, are all the same type of love, depending on our
attitude. Not the same type of love, but the...
The same.
I mean,
yeah,
what's better, a dog or a cat, you know? I can't say. But... what's this photosensitive spot? What does that have to do with, you know, our conceptions of what, say, love was? Now, he says somewhere in here, and I can't remember where, but he says, it's an odd book, this is an odd book to write, this is an odd thing to do, to talk about defining the various loves when most people haven't gotten so far as any of them. So the main problem is not that people love too much, but they love it all, any of these ways. He says, and it's funny, and yet he has to do it. He says, it is very important for people to know Eros and the dangers in it, and the joys in it, the beauty of it, and the health of it, and the perversity of it. But the strange thing is that most people never know it.
Well, do they not know it, and therefore
never experienced
don't act? Or they just don't know about it because they haven't read this kind of book.
Well, they haven't experienced any. It's not just an intellectual knowing. They just plain haven't experienced it. It's not. He says, like, let's take the one like friendship. Maybe that would be a better example. But with friendship, he says, this is the greatness of friendship and the health of friendship, and this is the perversity of friendship as the love, philia. You know, this is the health and this is the perversity. And he says, but the unfortunate thing is most people haven't even gotten to the stage of friendship. Have not even experienced it.
He also said friendship isn't necessary in life. And a lot of people, you know, you can go through our whole life without ever really experiencing friendship.
Mm-hmm.
So
he's saying first we've got to have some kind of, I mean, hopefully we could get to the point, and then it's very necessary to know the dangers.
In the introduction, you know, but he said it right there. He said, when you're born helpless, and as soon as we become fully conscious, we discover loneliness. And then what Kent said after that was that if one doesn't discover loneliness, he's not fully conscious. You know, just that's just switching words around. Mm-hmm. But it, you know, to become conscious of what there is love, and there is need love.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. And you'd say many people haven't gotten to the point of being conscious of an affection that was powerful enough to rival God, an Eros that was powerful enough to rival God, friendship that was enough to rival God. That's scary. And in many places here, much of my past takes place before he writes this book. He says, we won't be dealing with those. Because those don't have anything to do with it. I mean, that's that's itch and scratch. Yeah.
But do you think that if it is true that people never experience this, that their God becomes a search for it?
A search for?
Love, friendship. If you're assuming that Lewis is right, that people don't experience it, and that's, then would you say that for these people, a central problem, I'm going to put it that way, becomes a search for that, and that becomes their God. Love still becomes their God, or the search for love, or the search for friendship.
I think, yeah, I
guess. Because if people don't experience it, which I'm not quite willing to agree with that, but if that is true, then there are a lot of people that are searching for that, and that has become the central, their God is the search for love.
I get what you mean. I mean, Luther's thing is your God is what you can't bear the absence of, and in your loneliness, and you recognize that love is what you want, and you make if there's a chance that you get it. I mean, we have a need love toward God, but the chance that you'll get love if you are out there needing it is not that great. Wanting to get it. Love me, remember Bedazzle? Remember that one singer?
Mm-hmm.
Love me! Everybody walks away. Love me! Many people will think friendship is, it's like in talking about some of the guys from the place. Should many of them think that, it's just for purely a social reason that they'll maybe smoke dope or take drugs. Because that's, you confuse a kind of a camaraderie with friendship. Meet friends. You confuse the gathering around. That's one way, by the way, to get a feeling of camaraderie. Do something, get somebody else to do something that you know is wrong, breaking a law or something. Instant camaraderie. Boy, that's feeling of buddies. It's just great. One, and you just, cohesiveness, because you have to, for necessity, you've done something wrong. You bought an egg at house. I mean, that doesn't even have to be anything. Let's go get some rotten eggs and go egg the coach's house. Boy, that night was one of the best nights you've had. Boy, it seemed like all those guys were your friends. Because you had this one shared. Was it a shared vision? Yes, the coach's house. Eggs dripping down the side. But whatever, that feeling. You go get drunk. Get plowed on your, get plowed. And you get this feeling, oh, we must be the best of friends. Very close. And it's not friendship. He's not even going to talk about these things. It's not to the point. And much of our life is just wallowing around it. I mean, in the sense, in this camaraderie, in a kind of a mutual masturbation society kind of involvement with each other, which is not to the point of love. And it is frightening. And as you, and at least as I look back over some of my history, to know that much of it was took place before. He does away with much of what passed for years as friendship, eros, charity, philia, innocence. I won't talk about these because these are the selfish manifestations. These aren't. We'll talk about those. Those are the photosensitive spots. Doesn't make any no point to pluck out a photosensitive spot. It's got to be an eye first. I mean, to love someone to the point of it, you know, right up to the edge of being rival to God. That's important. But not to go over that line.
What you say, those are the selfish things. It reminds me of it, what he says in the introduction of the need love, you know, and so I have to look at that in the way of an inferior to such a point that it doesn't even approach the love of friendship and those things, you know, but somehow to make that synonymous with selfish doesn't settle with me.
Mm-hmm. That, well, there are certain things that...
the need love that we have, you know, having that there in our relationship with God seems to be very important.
Mm-hmm. Need love in relationship with God is.
And that has a selfishness about it. You know? It's not selfless.
No, that does with God. He does make that real exception. That it is basically out of poverty. That, you know, our relationship with God.
Okay, then when you say it in a human term, then the selfishness very much, you know, reeks of selfishness there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then when we go across, and we talk about a need pleasure. He talks about that later. He says, past reason hunted, past, let's see, how does it go? Past the line from Shakespeare, past. Past reason hunted.
Past reason hunted, and no sooner had, past reason hated.
And past reason hunted, no sooner had, past reason hated. The kind of pleasure, I think with this next chapter on the pleasures is important for what we're talking about here. That we have a pleasure that dies on the lips. You know, you're thirsty. You drink a glass of water and it's over. And much of our friendships have been like that. Much of our what we consider, maybe we vaguely would call eros, has been like that. And much of the affection has been like that. And the last ages are the death of natural affection. And that would mean the natural affection that one would have for someone, some old person, and a young child. And maybe much of our lives have been spent without that. Enough affection to even get to the point where it can be wrong. We don't even have a photosensitive spot. To give us these eyes instead of photosensitive spots, this book can help do that. As you start to see how big and beautiful each of these things are. It's where God does come to fill, complete our joy. You know, these are tremendous, beautiful loves. And we're many nights at a time mucking around in stuff that isn't even a shadow of it. A friendship, and you say, oh, I want a friend. And you go out and get a friend. There are lots of things ways you can get a friend, but not a friend like is being talked about here. You know, not at all. Friendship has something to do with shared vision. You know, something more than the coach's house and the eggs dripping down it.
It's also just for that time that you're together. I mean, then it kind of blows over as quick as it was there. Don't you kind of mean that?
As long as
just,
like,
yeah, when you're doing that thing, mm-hmm. or whatever, like a one night stand deal. Mm-hmm. You know, not no enduring or lasting thing mm-hmm. in it, like real friendship.
Yeah, and if you can't find it in your own relationship, you can find it in other people's relationships and in books. Lots of times you can recognize the sort of these withered little stumps of emotions and loves that we have. In literature, first. And then we can start seeing at moments in our time when what we offered was not a hand, but a withered stump. Well, let's look at this likings and loves where we just 15 minutes and get started maybe on this. I think we can get started on this next chapter. And he says, so that without, since the highest cannot stand without the lowest, we begin with likings, with pleasures. We begin with likings, with things that, likings. Then he is so beautiful. I love to watch this man think. And when I think that he did this off the top of his head, I just, you know, incredible. And he says, well, first, let's see, we're going to talk about likings with pleasures. Now, first, pleasures are divided into two classes. Those which would not be pleasures at all unless preceded by desire. Drink of water is a pleasure if thirsty. If not, it's nothing. The need pleasure. The need pleasure are those that would not be pleasures at all unless preceded by desire. And then the second class, pleasures of appreciation, those which are pleasures in their own right and need no preparation by desire. Those which are pleasures in their own right and need no preparation by desire. Unsought and unexpected pleasures of smell, for instance. When you walk by a lilac bush, that's a pleasure. Anytime. It's not preceded by a desire to smell a lilac bush. Unless that desire is built in.
Does that tie in a little bit too with what you said about looking at a waterfall? Is that a response or that? I don't know. Mm-hmm. For some reason.
In a sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. If
you look at a waterfall.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. The difficulty here in these two kinds, the need pleasures and pleasures of appreciation, the difficulty. We tend to laud need pleasures for being natural, necessary. Well, you hear this a lot, the need pleasures. Well, those are the natural ones. You know, a man's got this sexual impulse, see, and he's just got to have this pleasure. It's a need pleasure. It's natural. It's necessary. I mean, when you buy shampoo because it's herbal, natural. You got to be careful with the use of the word natural. Right? Now we laud these pleasures because they're natural. We're in an age where, it's natural. Then it's good. But it's natural, so it must be good. Cancer is natural, among other things. Necessary, huh?
It's organic too.
Yeah, that's right. Natural, necessary. You get this sense of necessity makes it right. But then if you say, what do I need? It's what you want. And then all of a sudden it's what I want. Is necessary and natural. And necessary and natural are God terms. I mean, for the guys in lifestyle who know that phraseology. And then, that's maybe a use that some people give it. That they laud the need pleasures for being natural and necessary. And then another group of people lauds the need pleasures because they're shielded from excess. They're shielded from excess. Faulkner has a line, the only thing in the curse of God is that the only thing a man can do for 8 hours is work. No. The need pleasures are shielded from excess, so they're not that dangerous, and so we can laud them, the need pleasures. The tendency has been to disparage appreciation pleasures because they're unnatural. Appreciation pleasures are unnatural. For instance, a dog can't understand it. Right? Much of what's talked about what the way men should be, must not be any different. A dog can't understand it. But the tendency is to disparage appreciation pleasures because they're unnatural. They're unnecessary in an age of necessity first, which is, talks about it. We're in an age of necessity first, and that same age is one of incredible excess, ridiculous, his word is superfluity, you know. But we have the sense that we're in an age of necessity, and my needs, these are necessary needs, I've got to fill them. And we have so much around, the appreciation pleasures are prone to luxury and vice. Now, one of the important things that he brings in here is that we know that through addiction, a pleasure of appreciation can become pleasure of need. A pleasure of appreciation can become a pleasure of need. Big deal, right? What's the big deal about that? Well, apply this to sexual intercourse. It can either be and we're not talking about love here, can either be sought pleasure of need or unsought pleasure of appreciation. A sought pleasure of need, an unsought pleasure of appreciation. The crucial word here is sought or unsought, conscious or unconscious, self-conscious or unself-conscious. Apply this to emotional needs, emotional appreciations. How conscious of our needs is it healthy to be? How conscious of our needs is it healthy to be? Let's stop there for a while. How conscious of our needs is it healthy to be?
Aware of them, but not obsessed with them?
But aware of those needs, obsession is always a problem. So how aware? Does, if we're conscious of those needs, does it rule out the surprise of what Lewis calls the super added gift?
You said needs of our emotions, right?
It can be, generally, but it's of. I mean, it wouldn't be like needs of food.
It wouldn't be.
Not at this point. Not at least in this, the way I'm asking this question. Does consciousness of need rule out surprise of the super added gift? Would consciousness of need guarantee dissatisfaction?
I would say that in case of needs, ignorance is bliss.
Mm-hmm. Ignorance is bliss. So if you were ignorant of your needs, do you think you would starve to death?
Well, that's why I asked you. You were ruling out food needs. You
said I'm using it metaphorically, though.
Oh.
How do you, in dealing with your needs, do you maybe forget your and put man's needs or something? Would that help?
Yeah, but I would be deaf if it's mine too.
Huh?
I would be deaf if it's mine.
Yeah, but what happens?
Either socially determined.
I feel deprived.
Dissatisfied?
Yeah.
It's got a guarantee of dissatisfaction if you're conscious of your needs.
Yeah.
You are conscious of your needs in a situation. It's just,
I'm sorry.
I mean, if you're you know, highly conscious of your needs, are you guaranteed dissatisfaction? Because we'll say more and more.
Maybe I wouldn't have had those as my needs necessarily.
And people's.
When I can, you know, I consider those as man's needs in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, man's need for love and man's need for friendship. Laws. If I didn't have those things, or if I saw those things as man's needs, and if I didn't have friendship, maybe I wouldn't feel proud. Maybe I would. Maybe there would be some sort of acceptance of it. Of it being a general need for man, but maybe I'm doing without for some reason at this time.
And you wouldn't maybe demand that you have instead of be without.
I don't know.
Yeah. And then now this we're toying with this haunting Philippians passage about look to the good, the true, and the noble, and so forth. I mean, it'd be good to know the needs. In other words, to talk about this, maybe a book like this. And to know as much as you can, and then forget it.
Why is it?
Keep it out of your consciousness if you can.
Why is it? I don't fit it in with Philippians.
Hmm?
I don't fit that in. Society.
To know what man's needs are, not to be completely ignorant of the kinds of needs, wide spectrum of needs that man has, and then if you get that consciousness of that wide spectrum of needs, if that's where you're looking, you can see how sometimes, you know, you can understand need and the fulfillment of need a little bit better. I mean, to look to those things and know them, but forget about those needs in yourself completely or 99% of the time or something. Because I can't say that it's you should be without consciousness of need. I can't say that. Because 1% of the time, at least, it's important to know when it hurts what to do about it.
Yeah, but what... See, I disagree, because...
With what?
That other than their needs to stay alive, the need of friendship, he points out, isn't a need. And if we overstress that, people are going to say, oh, I don't have any friends. It's terrible. And it's a very rare thing, the way he defines it.
Yeah.
It's something that very few of us are ever going to experience.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to overstress that as a need.
Mm-hmm.
Society doesn't get along very well, you know, without honesty became a big thing. You know, you got to be honest. Well, that turned out to destroy a lot of people. That became the god in T groups and all the... interpersonal groups in the late 60s, and some are still going on. They're helpful if they're handled right. But they're very destructive. Honesty became a means of destroying. But, you know, it was said that man needed honesty. Well, he needed a little lying maybe too.
Mm-hmm.
But not lying is the wrong term. He
not
needed a little compassion. You know, honesty took the place of compassion.
Well, self-conscious honesty is lying. I've never been able to try to be honest and never come up with anything. Try it with your wife sometime.
Yeah, right. But this is what some people do, and it was very destructive to people. It was not as helpful. And I'm saying that, you know, to stress certain things that have made some people happy as needs for everybody may just make a lot of people unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there is,
the renaissance of modesty, and we have a need to express ourselves, and so you sit down next to the quiet guy on the bus, and you say, ah, come on, quit being so...
I'm just saying is that the person has to accept himself, and this is where I see working for sanctification, when we're talking nearness to God,
mm-hmm.
is just accepting what you are, striving for nearness, knowing you're going to fail, because of original sin. But every morning you get up and you're going to try again.
Mm-hmm.
And some days you make it better than other days.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than to set up goals, you know, that...
Keeping accounts on yourself.
Right, to say, you know, I'm going to be honest, I'm going to try and make so many friends today, I got to love this many people. It doesn't work that way.
Or I need, and that's the point where you get the relationship between the needs and keeping conscious track of the needs and so forth, and is going to be destructive. And if I'm saying I need I need you to be a certain way, I need people, my friends, to be honest and so forth like this, and to support me and everything, and I say something and then you contradict me, and I say what?
So you have to be conscious. So what you have to do is you have to be conscious of the other person.
Other person's needs.
Right.
That's
right.
Why you have to know about needs.
Well, right. Okay, I'll buy it that way. You have to know about needs, but you also have to stress that, you know, that these are vary for all individuals, and you just have to be conscious, you know, striving to make life enjoyable for the people around you.
And in the process, your needs will be fulfilled according
hopefully,
to you.
Hopefully.
In your time.
Hopefully.
Well, that's, yeah.
What about the mother?
That
then?
Started that you disagreed with me, but I don't
think. Right, I don't think, I didn't know what you're talking about needs,
yeah.
So.
Yeah.
What about motherhood?
Oh, no, when you said that, you know, we have to be conscious of fulfilling other, and I agreed as far as I heard the servant, you know, our a servant has been redefined for me at Holden, but then I thought of the example in the book about the mother that had died, and they were really glad she died because she'd been fulfilling all of her, she really hadn't been fulfilling the needs, but that was her intentionality, that she began each day, you know, thinking of her husband and her son and daughter and waiting on them hand and foot, doing their laundry when it should have been off. Do you remember that example in the book?
Yeah.
If I remember, and he's saying that it was not good on her part.
Yeah.
Right, that's correct.
It's demonic.
Right, because that was to fulfill her needs. I was saying,
what
I guess
that fine
what
line
you have to say is,
you
can't push the statement to the extreme. Your life isn't just to make everybody happy around you. I mean, I'm just saying that there's better ways. There's no way to go out of your way to make people unhappy. To fulfill your needs. I mean, I can find, you know, you can put other people down to make yourself look good, and that's one example. I'm not saying that, you know, I didn't mean to set down any rules of how you should act. I'm just the opposite. You have to decide, you know, what you are and go about your life. And deciding that this is what Christianity means to you, this is what you think you have to do, this is what you're going to try to do, and you know darn well you're going to fail. But you're going to try again the next day. And that's where I see sanctification in Christ. It just gives you the strength to know you're going to fail and try again.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to add one more thing on this need thing now. I took it after you were done.
Right.
But since the bell rang, I had to jump in there without that, you know, that courteous pause. But the thing on the need, how conscious of our needs is it healthy to be? Our needs, no. But we were talking like the loneliness. It's good to know 1% of the time, because sometimes we get broken legs. And we can't cut off those, you know, the nerve endings from our needs to, you know, I don't know where they go. The metaphor is just falling flat on the floor. But how conscious of our needs is it healthy to be? Not much. Does consciousness of need rule out the surprise of the super added gift? You bet. And we can turn joy, you know, we can turn something that is joy into bitterness, you know, something that a person will do to bitterness. You know, the same thing happens, but we'll see, you know, we're deprived instead of we're given, blessed, you know. This thing from Babel comes out, you know, the healthy man gives thanks. A grateful man is a healthy man. If you're not grateful, if you're not giving thanks, you're sick. Well, you know, a real long consciousness of needs guarantees you're not going to be grateful or thankful. The super added, I love that, super added gift, the inevitable surprise of people being, filling your needs. That it should be a surprise. I pray that they're surprises. And because that consciousness of our need, my needs are this, so much time in the living room, so much time on the toilet, reading without being bothered by the children. And in any way, guarantees satisfaction. That consciousness guarantees dissatisfaction, I'm sorry. And Lewis's statement that, think life is a prison, don't think it's a hotel. You know, that you know what these needs are and then know, accept that life is a prison and not a hotel. And so if you're not served, I mean, you know, if you think it's life is a hotel, you're going to be mad at the service continually because you have a consciousness of what the hotel means. If you think it's a prison, you're going to be continually grateful to be proven wrong. And that gratefulness of being proven wrong is one of the greatest joys that I've ever experienced, to be proven wrong in such a nice way. And super added gift. And you don't deserve anything. And that's something that I really, and it's, oh, that's what, you know, that kind of a phrase that one, at once in my life would have just been bitter is one of the biggest joys. I don't deserve anything. So it's a life of gratefulness. It's not a gift.
Yeah. Well, I tried to make you happy by proving you wrong, but I can't.